great case, said Eddie. A lady of the lice. 79-year-old admitted from the floor of her room, found grimacing like the exorcist version of a Barbie doll. Plum-sized lymph nodes all over her body, thinks she's on the T-line in St. Louis, and has lice.
Lice?
Right. The creeping cooties. Nurses refuse to enter her room.
Okay, said Fats, no problem. The way to turf her is to find the cancer or find the allergy. We need skin tests, TB, Manilia, strep, fly shits, egg foo young, the works. One positive skin test explains the nodes, and it's a turf back to the floor of her room.
Putzel, her private, says he won't let this poor old lady go back there. He demands that we find placement.
Swell, said Fats.
I'll call Selma. Next, Sam Levin.
By the way, said EMD, I didn't have a chance to tell Putzel about the cooties. He's in there now.
A creeping coup.
Sam's an 82-year-old demented derelict living alone in a rooming house, picked up by the police for loitering. When the cops asked him where he lived, he said Jerusalem, and then he pretended to faint, so they turfed him here. Severe diabetes, he's a well-known pervert. Chief complaint is, I'm hungry.
Of course he's hungry, said Fats. His diabetes is burning his own body for fuel.
Lice and perversion. What are the Jews coming to?
To the Black Crow, said Hooper.
Insulin City, said Fats.
Rough turf.
Next.
You should know, said Eddie, that Sam Levin is a man who eats everything. Watch your food, Fats.
Fats got up and locked his locker, in which he kept a stash of food, including several prized Hebrew national salamis.
Next is Fast Tina the taxi woman, said Eddie, a private patient of the Legos.
At that, the cabbie started yelling about his fare, and Fats turfed him to help. He left, cursing, and in walked Bonnie, and said to Eddie, your patient Tina Tokerman's IV bottle has run out. What do you want me to hang next?
Tina, said Eddie.
That's inappropriate. Now, about the lice, it's not our job to delouse. It is the intern's.
Crap, said EMD. It's a nursing job, because nurses already got lice.
What? Well, I'm calling my supervisor. And as for the lice, I'm dialing help. We're having problems in communication. Goodbye.
Anyway, Eddie went on, there was Tina, and I thought, dementia. I'll go right for the money and invade. So first I did the LP.
You did the LP first. Did you ask the Lego before you did it?
Nope.
A private patient of the Legos sent 300 miles in a cab, and you started with a painful invasive procedure without asking him first.
Why?
Why?
It was either her or me, that's why.
Maybe she didn't mind it, right? Asked Fats.
Oh, she minded it. She screamed bloody murder. And at 3 a.m. I heard some maniac whistling, Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer true.
Daisy, Daisy, said Fats, looking out the window into the face of a hard hat hanging like a spider from the rising web of the wing of Zoc. It wasn't really the Lego who came in at that hour.
Why should he? I mean, there's no wing of Tokerman, is there?
Tina was so mad, she smashed me in the nose, and I got that stinging feeling all up and down my face and tears in my eyes. I realized then that I needed a big CVP line in her internal jugular in her neck.
You didn't put in a big CVP line because you know that the Lego hates them because they managed without them in his day and he can't understand them anyway, right?
Right, I didn't.
Good, Eddie, good, said Fats. But I tried like hell to, and as I was trying, the Lego came in and asked Tina, is there anything wrong, dearie? And Tina screamed out, yes, this needle in my neck, and the Lego turned to me and said, we managed without those in my day. Take it out and come see me tomorrow morning.
And Tina refuses to sign for dialysis.
Eddie, said Fats quietly,
Don't do what you're doing. Believe me, it's not worth it to antagonize these guys. Go easy. It's better to go easy, see? It's a tough case. The only relief for her dementia is dialysis, but the thing that keeps her from signing for dialysis is her dementia. A real tough turf.
How about holding a pen in her hand and scribbling her name with it? Asked Hooper. I do that to get my gomers to sign for posts.
Well, stop doing that. It's illegal.
No sweat, said Eddie. When Tina realizes that at night, when I'm on call, she's totally at my mercy, she'll sign, Fats. She'll sign.
Later that morning, Hooper and Fats and I were sitting at the nursing station. Fats was into his Wall Street Journal, and Hooper and I were watching the flow. We were still chuckling at having seen Lionel from Help, paged by the nurse, checking out the room numbers, and then, with a spiffy straightening of his blazer and forelock, entering the room of the Lady of the Lice. The room crawling with the crabs. Eddie had been called to the Lego's office, and we had been worried. But we were relieved to see the Lego come walking down the corridor with him, his arm around Eddie's shoulder. While we waited for the fish, so we could start rounds with our leggy chief, Fats collared Eddie and rushed us all into the on-call room, locking the door behind us.
All right, Eddie, said Fats. You are in serious trouble.
What do you mean? We had a nice chat. Go slow with Tina was all he said. He even put his arm around me as we walked back down here.
Exactly, said Fats. That arm around you. Did you ever look closely at the anatomy of that arm? Fingers like a tree frog's with suckers at the end. Arachnodactyly, like a spider. Double joints at the knuckles. Universal joints at the wrist, elbow, and shoulder. When the Lego puts his arm around someone, often it's the end of a promising career. The last guy he put his arm around was Grenade Room Dubler. And you know where he went for his fellowship?
Nope.
Neither does anyone else. I doubt if it was on the continental USA. The Lego puts his arm around your shoulders and whispers in your ear something like Akron or Utah or Kuala Lumpur. And that's where you go. I don't want my fellowship in the gulag. Get it?
Yours, asked Eddie.
And what about mine, in oncology?
What, you?
Cancer.
Natch, what could be better than a gomer with cancer?
Chief's rounds that day were introduced by the fish, and the patient was one Mo, a tough truck driver who'd had to wait in the freezing cold during the gas crisis to fill up his rig. He had a rare disease of the blood called cryoglobulinemia, where with cold the blood clots in small vessels. And Mo's big toe had turned as cold and white as a corpse on a slab in the morgue.
What a great case, cried the Lego. Let me ask a few questions.
To the first question, a real toughie, he asked Hooper. Hooper said, I don't know. And so the Lego answered the toughie himself and gave a little lecture on it. To the next question, not a toughie, to Eddie, Eddie answered, I don't know. The Lego gave him the benefit of the doubt and gave a little lecture, none of which was news to Eddie or to anyone else. The fish and the fat man were getting apprehensive about what we were doing. And the tension rose as the Lego turned to me and asked me an easy one that any klutz who read Time could answer. I paused, knit my brow, and said, Sir, I just don't know. The Lego asked,
You say you don't know?
No, sir, I don't, and I'm proud to say it. Startled and troubled, the Lego said, In my day, the House of God was the kind of place where on chief's rounds the intern would be embarrassed to say, I don't know. What is going on?
Well, sir, you see, the fish said that he wanted the house to be the kind of place where we'd be proud to say, I don't know, and, damn it, chief, we are.
You are, the fish said. He, never mind. Let's see, Mo.
The chief fairly burned with the excitement of getting at Mo the Toe's toe. And yet at Mo's bedside, for some reason, he went straight for Mo's liver, poodling around with it sensually. Finally, the Lego went for Mo the Toe's toe, and no one was sure exactly what happened next. The toe was white and cold, and the Lego, communing with it as if it could tell him about all the great dead toes of the past, inspected it, palpated it, pushed it around, and then, bending down, did something to it with his mouth. Eight of us watched, and there were to be eight different opinions of what the Lego did with Mo's toe. Some said look, some said blow, some said suck. We watched, amazed, as the Lego straightened up and kind of absent-mindedly fondling the toe as if it were some newfound friend, asked Mo the toe how it felt, and Mo said, "Hey, not bad, buddy. But while you're at it, could you try the same thing a little higher up?" "The Ten Commandments and chicken?" I asked the fat man later that night as we awaited our admissions and the 10 o'clock meal. "Right, Charlton Heston. Jews squashed under rocks, and then the House of God chicken with tire tracks. And Teddy." "Who's Teddy?" Teddy turned out to be one of the horde of patients who loved fats. A concentration camp survivor, Teddy had been brought into the house EW bleeding out from an ulcer one night when Fats was on call. Fats had turfed him out to surgery, and losing half his stomach, Teddy was convinced that Fats had saved his life. Teddy owns a deli and is lonely, so he comes in when I'm on call with a bag of food. I deck him out in whites and a stethoscope, and he pretends he's a doctor. Sweet guy, Teddy. Sure enough, as Fats and I and Umberto, my Mexican-American BMS, sat down in the TV room to watch the MGM lion begin to roar, in walked a thin, worried-looking fellow in shabby black. In one hand a radio spewing a melancholic Schumann, and in the other a big paper bag splotched with grease. As Moses grew from being a baby bull-rushing around the Italian extras to being a 6'3" Egyptian red-hot looking like Charlton Heston, Fats and I and Teddy and Umberto ran the ward via the Bell telephone system. Just about the time that God, playing doctor, handed down the Ten Commandments, saying, "Take these two tablets and call me in the morning," Harry the horse had chest pain. I sent Umberto to take an EKG, and when he returned, without looking at it, Fat said it was an ectopic nodal pacemaker taking over from the sinus node and producing chest pain. He was right. "Of course I'm right. Harry's private, little Otto, has worked out a method to keep Harry here indefinitely. Whenever Harry's ready to be turfed out, Otto tells him he's leaving. Harry wills his heart into that crazy rhythm with the chest pain, and Otto tells him he's staying. Harry's the only man in history to have conscious control of his AV node." "The AV node is never under conscious control," I said. "For Harry the horse, it is. So how do we get him to leave?" "By telling him he can stay." "But then he'll stay forever." "So? So what? He's a landsman, a brother, nice man." "So you don't have to take care of him. I do," I said, irritated. "He's no work for you. Let him stay. He loves it here. Who doesn't?" "I do," said Teddy. "Here was the best 6 weeks of mine life." As the Ten Commandments finished, we got a call for an admission from the EW, and Fats gathered us to him and said, "Men, pray that this is our sleep ticket." "What?" asked Teddy. "You need a ticket to sleep here?" "We need an admission around 11 that's not too much work so we can get to bed, and the rotation doesn't hand us another admission at 4 a.m. Pray, men, pray. The Moses and Israel and Jesus Christ and the entire Mexican nation." He heard. Bernard was a young 83, not a gomer, and able to talk. He'd been transferred from MBH, the house's rival. Founded in colonial times by the WASPs, the insemination of MBH by non-WASPs had taken place only mid-20th century with the token multidexterous Oriental surgeon, and finally with the token red-hot internal medicine Jew. Yet MBH was still Brooks Brothers, while the house was still Garment District. For Jews, at MBH the password was, "Dress British, think Yiddish." It was rare to get a TERF from the MBH to the house, and the fat man was curious.
"Bernard, you went to the MBH. They did a great workup, and you told them after they got done you wanted to be transferred here. Why?"
"I really don't know," said Bernard.
"Was it the doctors there? The doctors you didn't like?"
"The doctors? Nah, the doctors, I can't complain."
"The tests of the room?"
"The tests of the room? Well, nah, about them I can't complain."
"The nurses? The food?" asked Fats. But Bernard shook his head no. Fats laughed and said, "Listen, Bernie, you went to the MBH. They did this great workup, and when I asked you why you came to the House of God, all you tell me is, nah, I can't complain. So why did you come here? Why, Bernie, why?"
"Why I come here? Well," said Bernie, "here, I can complain."
As I headed to the bed on the ward, the night nurse came up to me and asked me to do her a favor. I wasn't in the mood, but asked what it was. "That woman transferred from surgery yesterday, Mrs. Stein?" "Metastatic cancer," I said.
"Inoperable."
"What about it?" "She knows that the surgeons opened her, took a look, and then just sewed her up."
"Yeah?"
"Well, she's asking what that means, and her private won't tell her. I think that someone should tell her, that's all."
Not wanting to face it, I said, "It's her private's job, not mine."
"Please," said the nurse, "she wants to know. Someone has to..."
"Who's her private?" asked Fats.
"Putzel."
"Oh. It's okay, Roy. I'll take care of it myself."
"You? Why?"
"'Cause that worm, Putzel, will never tell her. I'm in charge of the ward. I'll take care of it. Gotta sleep."
"But I thought you're telling me and Eddie not to make waves."
"Right. This is different. This woman needs to know."
I watched him enter her room and sit on the bed. The woman was 40. Thin and pale, she blended with the sheets. I pictured her spine x-rays, riddled with cancer, a honeycomb of bone. If she moved too suddenly, she'd crack a vertebra, sever her spinal cord, paralyze herself. Her neck brace made her look more stoic than she was. In the midst of her waxy face, her eyes seemed immense. From the corridor, I watched her ask Fats her question, and then search him for his answer. When he spoke, her eyes pooled with tears. I saw the fat man's hand reach out and, motherly, envelop hers. I couldn't watch. Despairing, I went to bed. At 4 a.m., I was awakened for an admission. Cursing, I wobbled into the EW cubicle and found Saul, the leukemic tailor, at whose remission in October we'd wept with joy. Saul was dying. As if enraged at the delay in its onrush of death, Saul's marrow had gone wild, spitting out deformed, cancerous bone cells that left Saul delirious with fever, oozing blood, anemic, in pain, and where the malignant white cells had failed to prevent the spread of his normal skin flora, his body coated with maggoty pustules of staphylococcus. Too weak to move, too mad to cry. Gums swollen and tongue bruised, he shooed away his wife and motioned me to bend down to him, and whispered, "This is it, Dr. Bash, right? This is the end." "We can try for another remission," I said, not believing it.
"Don't talk to me, remission. This is hell. Listen, I want you to finish me off."
"What?"
"Finish me off. I'm dead, so let me die. I didn't want no treatment. She forced me. I'm ready. You're my doctor.
so give me something to finish me off, okay?
I can't do that, Saul.
Crap. Remember, Sanders, I was there, next bed. I saw. Suffered? Terrible. Don't make me go like him. So, you want me to sign something? I sign. Do it.
I can't, Saul. You know that.
So find me someone who will.
I promise you'll have no pain. That's the best I can do.
Pain? What about pain inside, in my heart? What do I have to do, Dr. Bash? He said angrily. Beg. You don't want me to suffer like Sanders. You liked him, too, I know.
I looked into his bloodshot eyes, the infection creeping over the lids toward the conjunctival vessels that were pale because there were so few red cells, and I wanted to say, no, I don't want you to suffer, Saul. I want you to die easy.
There, see? It's a cinch. Please, finish me off.
As I continued to protest, remembering how Sanders had suffered and died, a horrible thought crossed my mind. Horrible, because for an instant it didn't seem horrible. Like seeing a baby and thinking of putting an ice pick through a fontanelle of its skull, the thought, yes, Saul, I'll do it, I'll finish you off. I began to work like hell to save him. I went back to the ward and came to the room with Putzel's terminal cancer woman. Fats was still there, playing cards, chatting. As I passed, something surprising happened in the game. A shout bubbled up, and both the players burst out laughing. After the next morning's card flip, when Fats had gone to eat and Hooper had gone to path, EMD got a silly look on his face and told me that Lionel the Blazer had paged him to look at some little red things on his gorgeous pubis that itched like hell. Eddie asked me what to do, and I said, do? You're a doc, so do what docs do. Examine him. Give me 5 minutes and do it in here. I got the operator to page Fats and Hooper and Selma and the nurses and the fish and housekeeping to come stat to Gomer City. And then I watched Lionel come up the hallway, look around cautiously, and enter the on-call room. I ran up to the group I'd paged and said, hey, I got paged to go into the on-call room, stat. And then the 10 of us rushed into the room. Lionel was blue-blazered only from the waist up and was sitting on the table naked from the waist down, pawing through his brown pubic hair. Eat My Dust was sitting across from him, lost in contemplation. When Lionel saw us, he went red and started to explain. He realized that he didn't want to explain and stopped and blushed and said, it's about a medical problem.
Crab lice, said Eddie. Lionel's got the venereal crabs.
Medical problem? I said. You know, we can't blame Lionel for this, no. We can only blame the system, the one that has paramedical personnel seeking free medical advice. How often is it that here in the house one gets tapped on the shoulder and hears, hey, doc, I got this problem. You got a minute? Lionel put on his spinnaker pattern briefs and his classy gray slacks and left. From that time on, whenever any of us ran into Lionel, we couldn't help but think of him in terms of his unblazered, crab-infested prick.
You shouldn't have done that, Bash, said the fat man, walking out onto the ward with me.
Why not?
Because with guys like the Blazers, you can't win. As soon as you engage in the struggle, you lose. Lionel's boss, the flunky Marvin, who assigns admissions, is going to make life miserable for you. Look, Roy, you're older than Hooper and Eddie. You can step back a little and roll with it. It's hard enough without Blazers and privates and slurpers making it harder.
Give in to these assholes.
I never said that.
What's the alternative? I asked, challenging him.
Don't let them use you, Roy. Use them.
How? Like this, said Fats, sitting down across from Jane Doe and taking out his stopwatch. Observe. What are you doing?
Using them.
In 10 minutes, I'll explain. Look, I want to go home. I'm going to sign out to Hooper.
Go ahead. Come back here in 10, and I'll explain.
I went into the on-call room and signed out to Hooper. And even though I knew he hadn't heard a word I'd said, I didn't care. And I got up to go home. Hooper was reading the manual I'd used at the beginning of the year, How to Do It for the New Intern, the section on How to Do a Chest Tap. I thought this strange, since we were more than halfway through the year, and a chest tap was standard procedure. As we had gotten into the habit of helping each other out, even if it meant staying around a little longer, I asked Hooper if he needed help. And he said, You mean Lionel? And I said, No, me. And he said, Nah, I'll just read this manual, and then go tap Rosebud's chest. I left him poring over the book and pointing his own finger at his own chest in the imaginary needle track he was going to take on Rosebud's. On the ward, I rejoined Fats, who clicked off his watch, turned to me, and asked, What didn't happen? I don't know. 10 minutes, Bash. And Jane Doe didn't fart.
So?
So her bowel is completely turned off, for the first time in house memory. That extract might just be a cure for that VA diarrhea. A good deed, a fortuna, just what I and the world need. Use 'em, Bash. Use 'em.
Did you and the fat man get along any better? Asked Barry.
Worse, I said. Not only does he love the Gomers, but he's acting like a Boy Scout. He keeps telling us not to fight back. He makes me search the whole place for a demented 97-year-old's eyeglasses, and then he spends the whole night sitting up with a woman with terminal cancer after he's told her she's gonna die.
He did that?
Yeah, why?
I never pictured him doing things like that. The way you described him, he seemed so cynical, so sick. Now I'm not sure.
He's not cynical enough. He's turned into a patsy. It's almost like he's deserting me.
He seems more reasonable now.
You're the one who's acting sick.
Thanks a lot.
I'm concerned, Roy. This acting out is dangerous. Maybe the fat man is right. Someone's gonna get burned.
I lay awake, chewing on Barry's concern.
It had been fun to say, I don't know, to get the fish, to get Lionel, to race around laughing and sarcastic. But there was a bud of bitterness in it that might blossom into savageness and make me sad enough to kill myself or mad enough to bite. I tried to get my worry in my hand, but I was a child grasping a sunbeam, opening my hand to find the light turned dark, the warmth gone. I drifted toward dream, finding myself ringside at a circus and seeing an elephant. Yes, an elephant. And seeing a busty girl and a musty elephant puffing dusty sawdust under the roused, busty bout and lusty, really big and busty red-hot tent of a big hot top. Wait. With some alarm, I realized that Hyper Hooper had been sitting in the on-call room reading my manual with his finger as his needle pointing. No, it couldn't have been. But yes, it was. Pointing in a straight shot, right toward Rosebud's the Lol in Nad's heart.
Chapter 16. Okay, Hooper, let's hear about the postmortem on Rosebud's. Let's hear what you, with your one little needle shot, have done.
Fats was flipping through cards as we lay in the icy ventricle of dead February, as it lay in the corpse of the year. There was no question that Eddie and Hooper and I were on our knees, and that they were breaking us. Most of the house hierarchies hated us. Gomer City was turning out to be the worst. Far from taking care of it, it was beginning to take care of us. The post on Rosebud's confirmed what we thought from when they sectioned the needle I used, said Hooper in a tone of contrition mixed with a certain professional satisfaction. I got spleen, lung, stomach, heart, and liver. Hooper paused. watching the fat man drum his fingers on the desk, and then went on. In other words, Fats, all the organs you named the other day, plus a helping of liver and stomach as well. I think it's a new world record for most organs hit with a single needle shot.
Liver? The liver's nowhere near where you went in.
I thought back to that day when Hyper Hooper had presented his attempt to tap the chest of rosebuds, and it told us that there had been a little bleeding. If a Californian isn't enthusiastic, it means a disaster has occurred. And Hooper meant that Rose was dying. He'd sent her to the MICU, and Fats, concerned and thinking malpractice, brought his Gomer City A-team to the MICU to see where the needle had gone in. The hole in Rose's chest was in the front, right over her heart. Fats had said, "Come on, Hooper. You didn't really put your needle in there, did you?" And Hooper had said, "Yep, that's what Roy's manual said, unless I had it upside down." Although Hooper had seemed a bit contrite when the fat man had said, "You never tap a chest from the front because things like the heart get in the way." Hooper had brightened right up and said, "It's okay, Fats. It's a great family for the post." "I know there's usually no liver," said Hooper, "but it seems as how in this case there was an aberrant lobe."
"Messy turf, Hooper. Messy turf," said Fats solemnly, slowly ripping rosebuds to shreds.
Again, Hooper had managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Holding up another card, Fats called out, "Tina? Eddie?"
"Dead," said Eat My Dust.
"What?" shouted Fats. "Tina, too? How? Who killed her?"
"Not me," said Eddie. "All I did was get her to sign for dialysis. The Legos crack dialysis team did the rest."
Tina had died by being inadvertently murdered by a nurse in dialysis who'd mixed up the bottles. Instead of diluting Fast Tina's blood, the machine had concentrated it further, and all the water had been pulled out of Tina's body, and her brain had shrunk and rattled around in her skull like a pea, while the nurse sat and read Cosmopolitan. Tina's pea brain had rattled and stretched until one of the arteries straining between her neck and thalamus burst, and she had hemorrhaged to death.
"Sorry to say this, Hooper," said Eddie. "But since Tina was my patient, it's another post-mortem for the kid."
"Stop," said Fats.
"Tina was Lego's patient. No post."
"But the Lego loves posts. He called them the flower—"
"Not when they prove malpractice," said Fats, in a tone that would hear no answer, all the while ripping Tina's card to pieces. "Next, Jane Doe."
"Hey, doing great," said Hooper. "I could have sworn that today she sat up and gave me a big hello."
"Never mind," said Fats, irritated. "That woman's never given any intern a big hello, and she's not going to start with an intern like you slobbering after her corpse. Any bowel activity yet?"
"Nope, no bowel sounds at all. Bowel might be dead. No nothing since you slipped her that extract of yours last month."
"That stuff is dynamite," said Fats.
"Keep running in the VA antibiotic, Hooper. We've got to turn her on again. Next."
We waded through all the rest, and ended with the Lady of the Lice, and Fats asked Eat My Dust if he'd found the cancer or the allergy.
"Who knows," said Eddie. "I'm OTC.
OTC? What the hell's OTC?
"Off the case," said Eddie. "New concept."
"Stop it. Pull yourself together. You can't be OTC.
"Why not?"
"Because you're her doctor. That's why. Get it?"
said Fats, mopping his brow.
"Jesus. Did you ever find the cancer or the allergy?"
"Nope," said Eddie's BMS. "The only thing we found was the sperm. Her last three urinalyses have come back sperm."
"Sperm? Sperm? In a demented 79-year-old Gomer?"
"Sperm. We think it's from Sam Levin, your pervert with diabetes."
That morning, the fish was taking us on a field trip. Hooper had gotten paged to see the Lego,
And while we waited for him, wondering whether the Lego had paged Hooper to castigate him for killing poor Rose Buds, or to congratulate him for obtaining Rose's tricky postmortem, Eddie and I continued to torment the fish in our usual ways until, eyeing us suspiciously, he left to make final arrangements. When Hooper reappeared, the fish loaded us into his station wagon for our field trip. On the way, he talked sincerely about Hooper killing Rose Buds. "You know, you can't possibly learn medicine without killing a few patients. Why, I myself have killed patients. Yes, every time I killed a patient, I learned a little something from it." It was hard to believe that he was actually saying that. And I drifted off, imagining the fish saying, "Killing patients is a special interest of mine. I have recently had the opportunity to review the world literature on killing patients. Why, it would make a very interesting research project." And by the time I snapped out of it, we were in the office of the Pearl. This was our second field trip. The fish took us on field trips to get us out of the house, to minimize the damage we were doing to his chief residency year and his career. The first field trip had been a ghetto health center where the fish had seemed ill at ease. This was the opposite. The Pearl had risen up through the house slurpers as easily as the fish might have wished, and by this time had become the richest private in the house, the city, perhaps the world. In his office, all was automated and set to Muzak. The Muzak played Fiddler on the Roof. The place was jam-packed. Lols and Nad getting their blood drawn, humming in tune with sunrise, sunset, waiting to move on around the corner where the tech and the Lol and Nad could hum tradition as the EKG was done. And then, further along past the sign that said, "This way to Anatevka," sure enough, there where the Lol and Nad had to give a urine sample, wouldn't she be bathed in the rippling, bittersweet strains of Anatevka, the song about the fiddler's lost home. Lastly, we and the Lols and Nad got a personal guest appearance by the Pearl in his private office, where he sat perusing the computer-processed results of the tests. Muzak played If I Were a Rich Man, and there, behind a dual flag holder in which were both Israel and the USA, sat Pearl, surrounded by original Chagalls and what looked like the original Hippocratic Oath. He was sweet and kind and generous, and seemed like the best damn doc, and he told us he was seeing an average of 119 Lols and Nad per day. No Gomers. On the ride back, I calculated that the Pearl made my yearly intern salary in 2 days. Turning to the fat mound next to me on the back seat, I said, "Fats, that was Money City." Of course. Even in the bowels of the non-stars, one can find the big fortunas. After the 10 o'clock meal, I went to see Molly on floor 6. She was mad at me for forgetting it was Valentine's Day and not getting her a gift. She yelled at me, and I felt guilty because I did like her, and I even found myself dreaming about her, which must have meant that I sort of loved her. And I really loved making love to her because she still moaned like a moist Mesopotamian every damn time. Theoretically, I had just as much interest in her, and I still saw her as a short-skirted majorette from St. Mesopotamia High, marching along, throwing her tan kneecaps first at one curb and then at the other, and masturbating the longest baton in the band between those far-flung thighs, producing MIs in the senile legionnaires lining the route. But I had been bombed on Gomer City, and my sexual stride had been broken. I knew I'd been screwing her, partly to affirm life. And the uneasy thought occurred to me, syllogistically, that since now I was not screwing her much, did that mean I'd ceased affirming life? I listened to her telling me I was getting dull and acting 30. And I realized that in some ways I was, because it seemed like such an effort to go out in the razored wind and blasting cold to see her, despite my desire when I was with her and my jealousy that maybe some other guy was wearing gold cleats and getting the hot oil and myrrh all over him. I began to warm to her and see her as sexy and loving right then and there,
and I reached out and put both my hands under her boobs, all tight-lifted and beruffled in her cute nursing costume, and I flashed on her blonde pubic hair, in which I'd nuzzled and laid my head and levered her to me and kissed her and remembered the round-the-town movements of her hips and lips, and we began to get as excited as we used to get in bed. I began to ask myself where that part of me that was willing to make the effort had gone, and I began to scheme about sleeping with her that night. But she pulled away and asked me to do her a favor, to check out a patient having agonal respirations. Agonal respirations means death. Is he supposed to die? That's just it. I'm not sure. He's got end-stage multiple myeloma and renal failure, and he's been in coma for weeks. But Dr. Putzel has never told the family, and there's an argument about his dialysis continuing, and about when he's supposed to die. It's all confused. I went and saw him. It was too much. Young man, gray and dying, filling the room with his stale ammonium breath. His human centers of respiration were dead, and phylogenetically he was breathing like a stranded fish. I went back to Molly and said, "He'll be dead in 15 minutes. He's not in any pain?" "No. The runt's been giving him morphine all night." "Good." Overcome with tenderness, because she and I were young and not dying, but one day would die, filled to our gills with morphine if we were lucky, I said, "Go draw his curtain, love, and come sit down with me and talk." The House of God found it difficult to let some young terminal guy die without pain, in peace. Even though Putzel and the runt had agreed to let the man with agonal respirations die that night, his kidney consult, a house red-hot slurper named Mickey, who'd been a football star in college, came along, went to see the agonal man, roared back to us, and paged the runt stat. Mickey was foaming at the mouth, mad as hell that his case was dying. I mentioned the end-stage bone cancer, and Mickey said, "Yeah, but we've got an 8 grand dialysis shunt in his arm, and every 3 days the dialysis team gets all his blood numbers smack back into line perfect." Knowing there was going to be a mess, I left. The runt came out of the elevator, fuming, and ran down the long corridor, his stethoscope swinging side to side like an elephant's trunk. I thought of the bones in multiple myeloma, eaten away by the cancer until they're as brittle as Rice Krispies. In a few minutes, the man with agonal respirations would have a cardiac arrest. If Mickey tried to pump his chest, his bones would crunch into little bitty bits. Not even Mickey, seduced into the Lego's philosophy of doing everything always for every patient forever, would dare call a cardiac arrest. Mickey called a cardiac arrest. From all over the house, turns and residents stormed into the room to save the man with agonal respirations from a painless, peaceful death. I entered the room and saw an even bigger mess than I'd imagined. Mickey was pumping up and down on the chest, and you could hear the brittle bones snap, crackle, and pop under his meaty hands. A Hindu anesthesiologist pumped oxygen at the head of the bed, looking over the mess with a compassionate disdain, perhaps thinking back to the dead beggars littering Dawn in Bombay. Molly was in tears trying to follow orders, with the runt shouting, "Stop! Don't resuscitate him!" and Mickey cracking and crunching and shouting, "Go all out! Every 3 days his blood numbers are perfect!" And yet the most sickening part of it was when Howard, pipe clenched like a bit between his teeth, ran into the room, with a nervous smile decided to take charge, and just like the turn in the How I Saved the World book, shouted out, "Gotta get a big line into this guy's stat!" Grabbed a humongous big needle, saw a pulsating vessel in the forearm, which happened to be the surgically constructed, meticulously protected shunt between artery and vein, which was Mickey's dialysis team's pride and joy, and, eyes glittering with big-time intern excitement, Howie rammed the needle home, destroying forever Mickey's continued attainment of perfection every 3 days. When Mickey saw this, he stopped crunching. His eyes got fierce as a linebacker's, and he went bananas, screaming, "That's my shunt, you asshole! That's my shunt! 8 grand to make it, and you wrecked my shunt!" That was it for me, and I left, thinking to myself, well, at least they'll end it here and not transfer the man with agonal respirations and crushed bones to the MICU. They transferred him to the MICU, where Chuck was the turn on call. When I went to see Chuck, I saw the family outside the MICU, weeping as Mickey explained things to them. Chuck was drenched in blood, bent over the residual mess of the man with agonal respirations, who now had no respirations at all except those generated by a respirator. Chuck looked up from the mess and said, "Hey, man, great case, huh? How are you doing?" "Pitiful. You know what Mickey said to me? Just keep him alive till tomorrow, for the family." "Something else." "What the hell are we doing this for?" "Money. Man, I want to be so rich. Black Fleetwood with gangster white walls and a funeral wreath in the back window." We sat down in the staff room and nipped at Chuck's Jack Daniels. He leaned back in his chair and crooned his falsetto, "There's a moon out tonight." And as I listened, I thought about how our friendship was becoming as wispy as Chuck's dream of becoming a singer. Chuck had been having a terrible time adjusting to his new city, one reason being he couldn't figure out where the graft was. Stopped for speeding and using the standard Chicago practice of handing the cop his driver's license with a $10 bill had gotten him a stern lecture about bribing an officer of the law and the maximum fine. Puzzled, displaced, he spent his time at home sleeping and eating and drinking and watching TV. His suffering showed in his waistline and his hangovers. I tried to talk with him about it, but he'd get that blank look on his face and say to me, "To me, fine, fine." Each of us was becoming more isolated. The more we needed support, the more shallow were our friendships. The more we needed sincerity, the more sarcastic we became. It had become an unwritten law among the turns. Don't tell what you feel, 'cause if you show a crack, you'll shatter. We imagined that our feelings could ruin us, like the great silent film stars had been ruined by sound. The runt came into the room, apologizing to Chuck for turfing the man with agonal respirations, but Mickey stormed in and asked how the man was. "Oh, fine," said Chuck, "just fine." "Right. He never should have gotten that morphine," said Mickey. "He was terminal and in pain," said the runt, getting mad. "He..." "Never mind. I'm leaving. Just keep him alive till morning."
"Till what time?" I asked nonchalantly.
"Till about 8:30, quarter to..." Mickey began, and then realizing what a fool he looked, he stopped, cursed us, and left. We sat finishing the bottle as the runt drifted off into his thing. Sex. Identifying him, isolating him from the trauma of the turnship and the hurt he felt inside, his sloshing around in genitalia at times got out of hand. At one point I'd found him on the phone, red in the face, screaming into the receiver, "No, I haven't been at home for a while, and I'm not going to tell you where I've been staying. It's none of your business." Tapping the phone, the runt had grinned his Hall of Mirrors grin and said it was his parents, and went on, "How's my analysis going? I quit. June, I quit her too. I know she's nice, Mother. That's why I quit her. I got a nurse now, a hot one. You should see her." I'd promised myself that if the runt started to tell his mother what Angel did with her mouth, I'd grab the phone and take over. "God damn it, Mother, stop it." "All right, you want to know what she does? Well, you should see what she does with her..." "Hello, Dr. Runsky," I said, snatching the phone from the runt. "This is your son's friend, Roy Bash." Two doctors' voices said hello. "There's nothing to worry about, folks. Harold is doing just fine."
"He seems very angry at me," said Dr. Mrs. Runsky.
"Yeah, well, it's just a little primary process stuff," I said, thinking of Barry. "Just a little regression. But what the hell, huh?"
"Yes," said the two analysts en chorale. "That must be it."
"I know this nurse. She's very nice. Don't worry. So long." The runt had been furious at me, saying, "I've been waiting to do that for 10 years.
"You can't do that.
Why not? They're my parents.
That's why not, Runt, because they're your parents.
So?
So you can't go around telling your parents about some nurse sliding around on your face, I'd screamed. Christ almighty, don't you use your higher cortical centers anymore at all?
The runt had become pure testosterone. Neither Chuck nor I wanted to hear the latest thunderous Harold Runtsky fuck, so we started to leave. Before he left us, the runt asked if we noticed anything different about him.
I'm not yellow, he said. It's been over 6 months since I got stuck with the needle from the yellow man, and I'm not yellow. The incubation period's passed. I'm not going to die.
While it cheered me to think that Runt was not dying, except at the rate we all were dying, I thought of Potts and what a terrible time he was having. The yellow man was still in coma, neither alive nor dead. Potts had suffered one disappointment after another, the most recent being his having to handle his mother as she raged at his father's funeral. Last time I'd seen him, he'd said he was down, that he felt like he used to feel as a kid when his family closed up the Pawleys Island summer house for the winter, with his mother emptying his room of all the things he loved and him looking back before leaving, at the bare floor, the sheet over his chair, his one-eyed doll propped up on the brass railings of his bed. Although he was contemptuous of the North, he was too polite to put his bitterness into words. He became more quiet. My questions, my invitations, seemed to echo in his empty rooms. He made it hard to be his friend. Leaving Chuck in the MICU, I said, "Hey, you got a great voice." "Not a good voice, Chucky baby. A great, great voice." "I know it. Be cool, Roy. Be cool." It was hard to be cool in Gomer City that night. The usual horrendous things had gone wrong with the Gomers. At midnight, I was hunched over a rose room rose, slamming the bed with my fist and hissing, I hate this, over and over again. But it was Harry the horse who did me in. Umberto and I had planned carefully, assuring Harry he could stay. We planned that night to zonk him with Valium and the next morning drive him to the nursing home ourselves. We had told no one of this, not even Fats. Early in the morning, I was awakened by the nurse saying that Harry was in a crazy cardiac rhythm and having a chest pain and looking like he was dying, and should she call a cardiac arrest? I yelled, awakening Umberto from the top bunk, shot to my feet, started to race out the door with Umberto following close behind, stopped suddenly so that Umberto slammed into me like a Keystone Cop and said to him, "Stay here, amigo. At your stage of training, you shouldn't see something like this." I raced to Harry's room where he was saying, "Hey, Doc, wait," and clutching his chest. And eye to eye with him, I screamed, "Who told you, Harry? Who told you you were going back to the home?" Knowing that now he could stay in the house, Harry said,
"Putzel."
"Putzel? Putzel's not your doctor, Harry. Little Otto is your doctor. You mean Dr. Kreinberg, right?"
"No, Putzel."
"Putzel?" And so Harry had succeeded in infarcting just enough more of his ventricle to stay in Gomer City for another 6 weeks, which was 2 weeks longer than me or Eddie or Fats or Hooper. And so he'd have fresh new turns and residents whom he could fool much more easily, because they probably would inform him when he was about to be turfed out, and he could go into his infarcting rhythm with plenty of time to spare. I had lost. Harry the horse had won. On the way back to bed, I passed the room with Saul the leukemic tailor. My tormenting him with my attempt, against his will, for a second remission had made him much worse. Comatose, by most legal criteria, he was dead. He would not recover. And yet I could keep him alive for a long time. I looked at the pale form. I listened as the pebbles of phlegm ebbed and flowed in his waves of breath. He could no longer beg me to finish him off. His wife, suffering and spending their retirement income,
had become bitter, saying to me, "Enough is enough. When will you let him die?" I could finish him off. I was tempted. It was impossible to shut out. I hurried past his doorway. I tried to sleep, but the phantasmagorical night whirled on, and by dawn so many things had happened to shatter me that I found myself standing at the elevator door waiting for it to come down so I could go up to Gomer City for the day's card flip, enraged, and about to blow. The elevator wasn't moving. I waited, and bashed on the button, and still it wasn't moving. All of a sudden, I went kind of nuts. I started banging on the elevator door, kicking the polished metal at the bottom and hammering the polished metal at the top, and screaming, "Come on down, you bastard, come on down!" Part of me wondered what the hell I was doing, but still I kept banging and kicking and screaming like an acromegalic cretin in labor, screaming at her fetus, "Come on down, you bastard, come on down!" Luckily, Eat My Dust Eddie came along and guided me to the card flip. When I asked him if he thought I'd gone off the deep end, he said, "Deep end? Ah, Roy, I think you were given that elevator just what the fucker always deserved." That morning at the card flip, thinking of how Putzel had putzled my discharge of Harry the Horse, I decided to counterattack, to start a rumor. I asked Eddie if he'd heard the rumor about how some turn had threatened to assassinate Putzel, to put a bullet through his brain. And Eddie said, "Hey, high-powered medicine, just what the fucker always deserved." "Why a bullet?" asked Hyper Hooper. "Wire his sigmoidoscope. When he presses the starter button, it explodes." "Listen to me, you guys," said Fats. "You've got to lay off Putzel. Kill this rumor right here and now." "You're worried about your fellowship?" I asked, taunting him. "I'm worried about my A-team. If you keep doing what you're doing, you're not going to make it through. Believe me, I know. I was there." "Go for the jugular," said Eat My Dust, as if he hadn't heard a word Fats had said. "Go for the booby-trapped scope. Kaboom!" As he thought it over, Eddie's eyes got big, and he licked his lips, and then he yelled, "Kaboom!" 2 nights later, when I was on call again, Barry insisted on coming in. Concerned with what she called my manic behavior and my borderline descriptions of what the Gomers were doing to me, and I to them, she thought that seeing for herself might help. She also wanted to meet Fats. Umberto and I took her around Gomer City. She saw them all. At first, she tried to talk with the Gomers as she would human beings, but recognizing the futility, she soon became silent. After our last stop, the Rose Room, where I insisted she listen through my stethoscope to the asthmatic breathing of a rose, she looked shell-shocked. "Hey, a great case, that last rose, huh?" I said sarcastically. "It makes me sad," said Barry. "Well, the 10 o'clock meal will cheer you right up." At the 10 o'clock meal, she watched as we interns played the Gomer game, where someone would call out an answer, like 1912, an answer given by a Gomer, and the rest of us would try to come up with questions to the Gomer that might have produced that answer, such as, "When was your last bowel movement?" or "How many times have you been admitted here?" or "How old are you?" or "What year is it?" or even "Who are you?" "Who am I?" and "Yippee?" "Sick," Barry said afterward, in a somber, almost angry tone. "It's sick. I told you the Gomers were awful. Not them. You. They make me sad. But the way you treat them, making fun of them, like they were animals, is sick. You guys are sick." You're just not used to it," I said. "You think that if I were in your shoes, I'd get that way, too?" "Yep. Maybe. Well, let's get it over with. Take me to your leader." We found Fats on Gomer City doing a manual disimpaction of Max the Parkinsonian. Double-gloved and surgically masked to filter out the smell, Teddy and Fats were digging at the endless stream of feces in Max's mega colon,
while from Max's huge, purple-scarred, bald head came an endless stream of, "Fix the lump! Fix the lump! Fix the lump!" From Teddy's radio poured Brahms. The smell was over.